This is the fourth day of this April 2010 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of the letters and lectures of Zen Master Dawi, 13th century Chan Master. And this is from the book Swampland Flowers. This letter is to a Lo Meng Pi. The obstruction of the path by the mind and its conceptual discrimination is worse than poisonous snakes or fierce tigers. Why? Because poisonous snakes and fierce tigers can still be avoided, whereas intellectual people make the mind's conceptual discrimination their home. There's never a single instant, whether they're walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, that they're not involved with it. As time goes on, unknowing and unawares, they become one piece with it. And not because they want to either, but because since beginningless time, they have followed this one little road until it's become set and familiar. Let's pause here. There are certain people, many of them, who relate to the world primarily through their thoughts. I mean, you can say that we all have thoughts filing through the mind all the time, sure. But these are people who just instinctively play with concepts, ideas, thoughts, and the interrelationships with them, making connections, weaving together this concept with that idea, and as he says, since beginningless time they have followed this one little road until it's become set and familiar. They've developed such a powerful, it's become such a powerful habit force that it's extremely difficult to avoid. It just sort of runs on its own power, this weaving of thoughts and connections between thoughts. It's very rewarding for them. It's pleasurable to make these connections, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that when it develops that degree of compulsivity, then we become dominated by it. We lose our freedom when we can't stop the mind from intellectualizing like that. Such people find careers in academia, and they can help a lot of people in those fields. But in terms of Zen practice, it is a real curse. But not one that is a hopeless burden. No matter where we start in our practice, no matter how clogged our mind may be with thoughts, and no matter how compulsively we default to playing with thoughts and concepts, we can, by and by, through practice, especially if it's if it's punctuated, our practice is punctuated by sesshins, we come to see another world. World, as I was saying yesterday, a world of feeling and acting, responding, and not this shadow world of thought dust. It's like a spider's web that we can get caught in. What we will see through serious Zen practice is we find some distance from it. We start to see that that isn't our whole mind. It's a kind of a sandstorm or a fog that rolls in at first very easily. But then we start to see that we have some choice. We don't have to enter that fog over and over and over again all the time. And then at the same time, what's happening is the world of direct experience acquires a vividness that is very appealing. We discover that we'd like to spend more time there, in touch with what's going on around us and feeling things, hearing sounds and smelling and tasting, seeing things, but not through the prism of our intellectualizing. We're talking here about really not just a difference in kind, but of just a degree. This is the basic affliction of human beings is to flee into thoughts. So it's just what we all have to contend with. But he's especially talking about very intellectual people who really get off on all of that thinking. Then he just finishes. Thus it is said that poisonous snakes and fierce tigers can still be avoided, but the mind's conceptual discrimination truly has no place for you to escape. That is, so long as we're involved with it. But then again, we do find the freedom to choose not to be in that gray world of thoughts. It's also, in particular, one type of this intellectualizing is being bound to logical thinking. Some people really find it becomes kind of a sanctuary for some people. It's a safe place. It's safe, this world of logic. You can rely on it. It's clean and it has its place to be logical. But the trouble is, like some kind of a runaway vehicle or an engine that you can't stop, it just takes over the mind and it becomes a kind of a box that becomes very difficult to get out of. There's a story in my favorite collection of stories. This is I've often read from this in Taisho, as did Roshi Kaplow. It's called The Man of Many Qualities. a legacy of the I Ching. And it's this big collection of stories and aphorisms and verses from all over the world, countries everywhere. And they're arranged under 64 sections that are based on the 64 hexagrams of the I Ching. It's just a way that the author, his name is it says here R-G-H-S-I-U. And that's the kind of structure he gave it, is arranging it into the 64 hexagrams. Anyway, there's one here by a Belgian writer, Maurice Maeterlinck, from the mid-1800s. He lived from the mid-1800s to the mid-1900s. And this is the story, or his contribution here. He says, if you place in a bottle half a dozen bees and the same number of flies, and lay the bottle down horizontally with its base to the window, you will find that the bees will persist until they die of exhaustion or hunger in their effort to discover a way out of the glass, while the flies, in less than 2 minutes, will all have sallied forth through the neck on the opposite side. It is the bees' love of light, it is their very intelligence, that is their undoing in this experiment. They evidently imagine that the way out of every prison must be where the light shines clearest, and they act in accordance and persist in too logical action. To them, glass is a supernatural mystery they never have met in nature. They have had no experience of this suddenly impenetrable atmosphere. And the greater their intelligence, the more inadmissible, more incomprehensible will the strange obstacle appear. Whereas the feather-brained flies, there's hope for some of us. The feather-brained flies, careless of logic as of the enigma of crystal, disregarding the call of the light, flutter wildly hither and thither, and meeting here the good fortune that often waits on the simple, who find salvation where the wiser will perish, necessarily end by discovering the friendly opening that restores their liberty to them. This would change this one thing. Who find salvation where he says where the wiser will perish. We could make that where the more intellectual will perish, those who are more full of facts and knowledge. Or to offer up a much more brief statement that I'm sure many of you have heard. But logic is an organized procedure for going wrong with confidence and certainty. And then his next letter. Gentleman of affairs. This translator loves that saying, or maybe it's Dawi who loves that phrase. I guess it means people who are successful in the world, who have found a way to make their way through the world and successfully and are very competent. I don't know. Gentlemen of affairs often take the mind which assumes there is nothing. No, excuse me. They often take the mind which assumes there is something to attain to seek the Dharma, wherein there is nothing to attain. What do I mean by the mind which assumes there is something to attain? It's the intellectually clever one, the one that ponders and judges. And then what do I mean by the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain? It's the imponderable, the incalculable, where there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness. I think of working on a koan, especially a fundamental, a breakthrough koan like Mu. The imponderable, the incalculable, where there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness. It's exactly what makes koans so such good medicine for, especially for the intellectually inclined among us, and also often what makes them so enticing. They've always found success in using their intelligence to solve problems and get ahead. And then they run in headlong into a koan, and it just doesn't work. And it's a good thing, because that's how many of us discover the mind, this vast mind that is beyond our discriminating intellects. Here where he says this mind, the intellectually clever one, the one that ponders and judges, and the one that is always strategizing, calculating, rehearsing, dwelling in the past, knitting together memories and thinking about what's happened in the past, or projecting the mind into the future, planning, anticipating, predicting, rehearsing, calculating. And then, skipping a paragraph, here Dawi says, an ancient worthy had a saying, transcendent wisdom is like a great mass of fire. Approach it, and it burns off your face. And by that, of course, he means face here. It would stand for the mind that discriminates. This transcendent wisdom is what transmutes mind with a small m into mind with a capital M. It reveals, this original face of ours reveals the formlessness of this world of form. The way in which, despite all appearances before us, there is also, at the same time, coexistent with this world of form and appearances, is this featureless realm beyond time, beyond space. He goes on, if you hesitate in thought and speculation, you immediately fall into conceptual discrimination. And he quotes one of his predecessors, Yung Chia, who said, loss of the wealth of the Dharma and destruction of virtue all stems from the mind's conceptual discrimination. let's just clarify. I've learned that people can misunderstand this kind of teaching and think that Zen has a basic quarrel with the higher mind, the functioning of our mind, and that's not at all the point. The point is our attachment to it. He says, hence we know that mind's conceptual discrimination not only obstructs the path, but also can make people mistaken and confused, so they do all kinds of things that are no good. Well, it is our discriminating minds that through the habit of dividing, discriminating, convinces us of a fundamental differences between us and them, for example. We Democrats and those Republicans, or we Americans and those Iraqis, or we Yankees and those Red Sox. There are unlimited ways that we find a way to identify with one category, and then find ourselves in opposition to another category or categories. It is really this habit of dividing what is essentially indivisible. It is that habit of doing that, and not only doing it, but then believing that those discriminations go all the way down to the bottom of things. It's that really is the root of all conflict and all war. And above all, my religion as opposed to their religion. Us and them, us and them. He goes on, once you have the intent to investigate this path to the end, you must settle your resolve and vow to the end of your days not to retreat or fall back so long as you have not yet reached the great rest, the great liberation. There's not much to the Buddha Dharma, but it's always been hard to find able people. The concerns of worldly passions are like the links of a chain joining together without a break. Those whose resolve is weak and inferior time and time again willingly become involved with them. Unknowing and unawares, they are dragged along by them. Only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower will she consent to step back and reflect. This is what one of the many benefits of Zen practice is, developing this all-important quality of detachment, of noticing. It starts with noticing. We notice when we're getting swept up in anger or sexual compulsions or any other kind of blind passion. We notice that it's happening and we can stop ourselves. We can step back and get a little distance from it. This is a tremendous evolutionary leap to be able to do that. To have the presence of mind to notice what's going on instead of completely being identified with the passion. This doesn't mean not being passionate. Passionate has its place, but it means having the freedom to choose whether to go with the emotion of the moment or to exhale and choose not to go there. Gentlemen of affairs make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear a person of knowledge speak of the Dharma in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. I take this really to me. I don't know how many people would report that they're afraid of falling into emptiness when they hear someone lecturing on the Dharma, but we can understand this as a fear of letting go. That's really what it means, letting go of thoughts. They fear falling into emptiness. Whenever I see someone talking like this, I immediately ask him, is this one who fears falling into emptiness himself empty or not? Of course, the basic Buddhist teaching and the experience of awakening is that yes, each one of us is fundamentally empty in the sense that we are energy in flux. There is no fixed, permanent self. So when he says this to such a person, he's trying to point out, look, you're already in emptiness. You already are empty. Where can you fall that would be any different? It's all empty. It just gives the appearance of substance. Don't worry about it. But he says, I immediately ask him, is this one who fears falling into emptiness himself empty or not? 10 out of 10 cannot explain. Since you have always taken thought and judgment as your nesting place, isn't that great? Nesting place. As soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, immediately you're at a loss and can't find your grip. You're far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life. And this is really the underlying problem with being unable to let go is thinking that we gotta hang on to these thoughts, because without thoughts, what is there? What is the mind without thoughts? Well, the mind without thoughts is or who needs thoughts for those things? Eating, drinking, making love, smelling the fresh air. Then we're reminded that this is a letter to a real person, where he says, Tun Li, my friend in the path, when we met in Pien in 1126, you were of mature age and already knew of the existence of the great matter. But with your vast erudition, you have entered too deeply into the 9 classics, these are the Confucian classics, and the 17 histories. You are too brilliant, and your lines of reasoning are too many, whereas your powers of stable concentration are too few. You are being dragged along by your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. Thus, you are unable to make a clean break right where you stand. Again, to repeat, there is no reason for anyone to lose heart, even if you recognize yourself as someone of an overactive intellect. There were many of these great masters themselves had such minds. And you read the biographies, as we often do in Taisho, the biographies of some of these illustrious masters. They start out by mastering all the classics and doing remarkable things. But then they have the extraordinarily good karma of recognizing that that's not any way to ultimate peace of mind and to helping others. And then they're off and running. They see the limitations of this intellectual mind. And that's when they come alive. He refers to this trajectory. He says, if correct mindfulness is present at all times and the attitude of fear for birth and death doesn't waver, this is seen as a very positive thing in authentic spiritual practice, is facing one's the certainty of one's death and the uncertainty of the time of death. It's no greater spur, no greater impetus to real powerful spiritual practice than facing one's mortality. And the attitude of fear for birth and death doesn't waver, then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar, that is, this world of direct experience, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale, the world of thoughts, will naturally become fresh. And then he says, but what is the stale? It's the brilliance and cleverness, that which thinks and judges. What is the unfamiliar? It's enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, the Buddha nature, where there's no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach, where there's no way for you to use your mental arrangements. As Sesshin goes on, this distinction between the fog of thoughts and the clarity, the bright clarity of no thought, no mind, becomes more clearly drawn. We notice more as the session goes on. We notice when thoughts are rolling in and can leave them alone and stay in this wonderful blackness of no thought. Meister Eckhart referred to this realm when he said, if you wish to know the road you tread on, you must close your eyes and walk in the dark. Really, this is the purpose of the particular practice that each one of us is working on, the koan, the breath, shikantaze, they're all deliverance systems to take us out of the light of knowledge and attachment to thoughts into this great sublime darkness that is a world of no thought. If we can put all our faith in our particular practice and just pour ourselves into it without holding back, just continually returning our attention to that practice, then we will find ourselves ushered into this marvelous, marvelous freedom of no thought, this potent darkness, this womb of enlightenment. And he says, suddenly the time arrives. You may be working on a koan. Well, he actually says, you may be on a story of an ancient's entry into the path. Well, that might well be, it's often a koan, or just a story of an awakening account, such as there are in the Three Pillars of Zen. You may be reading such a story, or it may be as you are reading the sutras, or perhaps during your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. Whether your condition is good or not good, or your body and mind are scattered and confused, whether favorable or adverse conditions are present, or whether you have temporarily quieted the mind's conceptual discrimination, when you suddenly topple the key link, there'll be no mistake about it. It can be shocking how quickly one can be out of the net of thoughts. This is hard for people to believe who feel most trapped in their thinking mind, but it can suddenly just fall silent like this. More commonly, awakening occurs when the mind has been settling and quieting. It's more commonly a steady entrance into that silence, but you just never know. There's the famous koan where a certain great scholar who has mastered the Diamond Sutra, the Great Diamond Sutra, has been lecturing on it for years and acquired a great reputation as the master of the Diamond Sutra. Obviously someone of a very, very keen and subtle intellect who meets a Zen master, Lungtan, this is China, and the master indulges him in discussing the Diamond Sutra deep into the night, and then the master finally says, it's getting awfully late, you should go. And Dershan, his Japanese name is Toksan. Let's call him by his Chinese name. It's easy to pronounce. Dershan turns and is about to leave, walk out the door, and he sees it's dark out, pitch dark. He realizes that he's not familiar with the area, so he turns back and he says, it's dark out. And the master gets hold of a candle, lights the candle, hands him the candle, and just as Dershan reached to take the candle, Lungtan It's pitch dark now. That moment, Dashan came to enlightenment. Stop now and recite the four vows.